We got a dream beyond capitalism. There's a lot of effort and energy around post-neoliberalism. And what does that mean? But again, based on our racially capitalistic society, how can we really reimagine an economy where we own, we co-own, we control, we're not exploited, people can thrive and live and not have to work 15, 11 jobs to be able to support their families? Those are the kind of things that we really want to imagine.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. My guest today, Taifa Butler, is the president of Demos, a nonprofit public policy organization working to build a just, inclusive, multiracial democracy and economy. Something that it is very important to remember we are trying to do in this era of challenge to those goals. Butler came to Demos after nearly a decade at the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute, where she served as its president and CEO. Prior to that, she was the policy and communications director for Georgia Family Connection Partnership. I really enjoyed hearing Taifa's story. If you're interested in who is working on a positive progressive vision for the United States, you should know about Demos. So, after a quick word from my sponsor, my interview with Taifa Butler of Demos.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
So, Taifa, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Taifa Butler, and I am the president of Demos, and I've been in this role for a little over 2.5 years. July of this year will be my third anniversary.
That's a pretty big job, is my sense. An important think tank and substantial budget, and must be a nice place to have taken yourself with your career.
I will just say this. It's been a daunting moment, you know, after the pandemic in 2020. And I had spent more than 2 decades of my career in Georgia doing policy work. So when this opportunity came to become the president of Demos, it, at a time when our democracy and our economy were both on fire, one might say, was a daunting moment to really think about moving to a national role and position to do incredible work with an organization that I deeply admired. I was on the board of Demos for about 4 years before I stepped into the president's role. And as a state policy leader, leading a think tank in Georgia, prior to this role, to talk a little bit about that, I was the president and CEO of the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. So a good bit of my policy background and experience had been in fiscal policy and economic policy, really working to build better economic opportunity for all Georgians. And I led a think tank there for about 6 of the 10 years that I was with that organization.
Where did you grow up originally?
Grew up in Philadelphia, born and raised, and first-generation college student. And it took me leaving Philadelphia to have a real appreciation for the city, but it is one of my favorite places.
Tell me a little about your family.
Yeah. So I, again, first-gen college student. We grew up initially in South Philly, and it took me going to college to really understand how segregated Philly was coming up, much like many of the big major cities. We lived in a neighborhood called Logan in North Philadelphia, and I had a ton of family that lived in North Philly.
Does that mean there were not a lot of white people, for example, around where you lived? Or
not necessarily. When we first moved to Logan in the 70s, it was one of those very mixed neighborhoods. And we had Portuguese and white families and older families that lived on our street. And as more and more families of color moved into the neighborhood, those families started to leave. And it took me going to, you know, grad school to figure out, oh, this is what white flight meant in the 70s and 80s. So yeah, I had a really, really great childhood experience in the city, went to Philadelphia High School for Girls, went to Mount Holyoke College. So I've had 8 years of single-sex education, which I think was a phenomenal foundation for me as a Black woman. It really gave me an opportunity to cultivate my leadership and my confidence and really set me on this trajectory.
My wife went to Wellesley College, which is something of a similar experience, I think. What was it about that single-sex education for you that was formative?
I think it was one that very much was all about women's empowerment. And of course, at that time, it was just the motivation that women can do and be anything. And I think it was a very defining moment for me growing up in Philly. And I tell this story all the time, but it really set me on my trajectory as a young person in the city, seeing a lot of injustice. You know, Philadelphia, as I was growing up, had a lot of racism seen in the policing in the city. And I always had this sort of mindset that I wanted to grow up. I wanted to be a politician. I wanted to stand on my Christian values and principles and lead with integrity and really make a difference. And when I was 16 years old, I got a chance to serve as the city manager of the city. The youth took over the city for a day with a partnership with the city government and the Police Athletic League. I was very active in PAL as a young athlete and a young leader in my neighborhood. And anyway, we got to run the city, and the city manager at that time, James White, who just, again, was an incredible leader. I got to go around, you know, every meeting that he had, which I had no idea it was foretelling what careers were like with meetings every 5 minutes. But it was really, really exciting to see sort of city government up close. He managed 11,000 employees. I got to go into all these different meetings. And when I realized how much power and influence he had as a city manager, initially I was disappointed that I wasn't the mayor for the day. But I learned quickly that the city manager was a strong manager. And he said to me, you know, Taifa, the life of a public servant is not about having your name in lights. It's about solving public problems. That has stuck with me my entire career. I see myself as a problem solver.
I wish all of our leaders had that mentality, that it wasn't about their name in lights, but solving public problems. You sounded like you were a fairly ambitious young woman. Is that true?
It was true. It is true. When I look back at my career and the leadership opportunities that I had, graduating from a K-8 elementary school, I graduated president of my eighth grade. When I got to high school, I was on the executive council in my ninth and 10th grade. I was president of my junior class. I was president of the school in my senior year. So yeah, I was ambitious.
That's awesome. You also mentioned, just as an aside, that you were an athlete. I was curious about in what?
Yeah.
What level? Yeah.
I played basketball and I played volleyball. I played volleyball for about 3 seasons and made the varsity team my junior year. I think I played 3 years of basketball as well. One of my proudest moments was being beat by Dawn Staley when our team faced Dobbins High School, which is where Dawn Staley went, who is now the coach of, you know, University of South Carolina.
Yeah. Well, anyone could be beat by Dawn.
That's right.
Out of curiosity, how tall are you?
I'm 5'7".
Okay. You must have been pretty skilled at that height to be a starter.
Well, yes. In that third season when I played varsity, I was a small forward.
Got it. So you studied politics, economics at Mount Holyoke?
Yes.
Was that part of sort of undergirding a political career down the road, or how were you thinking about it?
Absolutely. It was something that I thought I needed. Again, at 16, thinking my long-term trajectory was I wanted to set myself up to be able to run for office and hold the position to do good public work. And so when I got to Mount Holyoke, I quickly learned that political science wasn't a thing. There's no science in politics. So we didn't call political science political science. We called it politics. And I minored in economics, thinking, again, I need to understand how this economy works. I also at that time did a little bit of a pivot because I was thinking I wanted to do international relations work, be an ambassador to, you know, Francophone Africa. So I was studying French. And it was my junior year that I took a domestic policy course and realized that we have our own problems here in this country and I needed to stay here and fix it. So I pivoted and went to grad school and focused on public policy.
Young folks in particular are curious about how to enter this part of the economy, how to enter the world of politics, whether it's in the campaign world or the policy world or the governing world. Tell me about your route after college into the workforce.
Great question. So I did a few research projects. I was a research fellow, a Fort Mellon research fellow in my junior year. So I got to do research. And my research was around AFDC as it was about to turn into TANF, the public assistance program under Clinton, and was being reformed. And there was a big welfare reform. So it sort of cut my teeth on research and sort of the connection to policy. And going into graduate school, initially, my thought was I wanted to get a law degree because I wanted to understand the law. And of course, every politician has a law degree. And I thought that was a prescription for success. But I never had the desire or the heart to be a lawyer, to be an attorney. And when I started to peel that onion, people said, no, you don't want to do that. Public policy is the way to go. And so having studied public policy, I went to Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. I think what I learned through that master's program is that there are various avenues that you can take once you have the skills to do policy analysis and data analysis. And Carnegie Mellon's program, as you could imagine, being such a quantitative engineering school, it was a very quantitative program. So we came out with some very strong quant skills. So I could go anywhere. So I went to the private sector for a little while doing data analysis and research work and made my way into the nonprofit sector after that and really connected back to my research roots and my sort of housing roots. I did several housing internships throughout my college career. So I was almost typecast a little bit with housing and research, but I ended up being able to break out of that.
What was the first job you think you had that you thought, wow, this is really a fit for me?
I had an opportunity to become a research associate when I moved to Georgia and really learned about sort of program evaluation and programs that were all over the country working to address different challenges, public policy issues, whether it was high school completion or, you know, child abuse and neglect. What are some of those programs that have really proven practices that they work and can make a difference? And then I had the opportunity to take that information, that research, those proven practices, and really go into communities and say, hey, if you're interested in working on youth development or making sure young people have opportunity to be successful academically, here are the prescriptions. Like, here are the things that have been researched and proven to work well. And it was that interaction with community, being able to sort of take the research, take the ideas and translate it to people who were on the ground really trying to make a difference. That's where I got a lot of fulfillment.
There are people who are in the world of policy analysts who stay in that. And then there are some who kind of move into the leadership ranks in organizations. And you seem to be in the latter category. What was it, do you think, about you and your work and how people saw you that ends up elevating you into that kind of job?
Partly, I think people just saw that I had the skill with people and being able to communicate and bring people along and help people feel connected to work and their understanding of like how to contribute. And I think that just helped me be able to elevate. And throughout my career, I've had a job and then was able to sort of step into more leadership role kind of year after year. And it just really worked out where, one, I have, I think, strong communication skills, and that always helps, especially when you're trying to communicate difficult concepts. For example, doing tax and tax policy work for so long, it would be really rewarding for me to be able to go into communities and talk about the budget. And people say, oh my gosh, I thought it was so difficult, but you made it so plain and so simple and so easy to understand. And I think as a person who's done research for most of my career, and now I'm in a position to ensure that the kind of research and the policy ideas that we're trying to develop as an organization translates to the people and that people really understand them. And that's where I'm really excited about the work of DEMOS, because as a think tank who's been doing this work for around 24 years, who centers people and centers our relationships with the field, that we don't just see ourselves as an ivory tower or only talking to the elites or elected officials. But at the end of the day, what I've learned in terms of policy work and policy change, you have to work on the political will, but you also have to work on the public will. And that's where I just thrive.
Yeah, I mean, that comes through just talking to you in a few minutes. Tell me about the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. How did you land there? And tell me about your kind of work as a employee there.
Yeah. So I took on the role of deputy director at the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute after nearly a decade working at the Georgia Family Connection Partnership. And that's where I was working with communities, helping to provide technical assistance around their policy work or their community work, and really bringing data and sort of policies to the community work that they were doing to try to address these challenges they saw in their counties. And I actually ran for office in 2010.
Bad year.
yeah. But I ran for school board in my local county in Georgia. I still had this in my head that, you know, in order to make real impact and real change, being a politician and being able to really make policy is the way to go. Anyway, I lost that election by 400 votes, but who's counting?
400 exactly, right?
That's right. The executive director of the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute reached out to me and said, I've been watching you in your career. And I at that time was the co-manager of the Georgia Kids Count Project. And I got a chance to go around the state to many of the 159 counties in the state of Georgia and really talk about how poorly children and families were faring in the state, talking about data, talking about what our commitment needs to be as practitioners and policymakers to really make children's and families' lives better. And anyway, in that work, he said, hey, I really would love to get you to come and be my deputy to help me strengthen the organization and help our policy work be more effective and impactful. And so I jumped at the opportunity to join GBPI at that time.
What did you like about it?
One, because I was working for a nonprofit that was doing this intersectional work of policy and community building and planning, being at GBPI, I think, gave me the opportunity to, one, really influence policy and policy advocacy, where I was before was very much, you know, a little bit more focused on just community building and support. And I was the policy director there. But being able to be at GBPI and really go deep on budget advocacy and fiscal policy advocacy. And at that time, we were a multi-issue organization. We did advocacy around taxes in general, but also around K-12 education and higher ed, economic security and public benefits programs and healthcare. So we were a multi-issue organization, and I was able to become a really good generalist, you know, looking at all these issues together and how all of them are required to really ensure that all Georgians had the kind of economic opportunity that we wanted. And what I was really excited about was on the journey of not only building the organization and strengthening our policy agenda, what I thought was my biggest contribution, even though I became CEO and did that for 6 years, it was taking this organization that did incredible work and did a lot of defensive work. All the bad things that could happen around budget and in a state like Georgia that had a lot of conservative leadership that didn't want to fund the things that we cared about, was to be able to also be proactive, not just put out the fires, but say, what's the vision that we want for families in this state? And then what's our policy work to actually get there and be a lot more strategic about the kind of policy solutions that we were putting together. And I just got to the point where in my career, I wanted to stop talking about the problem and talk about the solutions. And I think as researchers, we can define the problem all day and talk about it all day. And we know that there are systemic issues that have happened happened that have created the problems that we're naming with the systemic solutions. For us, especially for me, working at this intersection of like children and family well-being and policy, and we look at poverty and we look at, you know, all the things that have happened that keep families from actually thriving, what are the things that we can do that are more than just trying to put a Band-Aid on poverty and put a Band-Aid on the barriers, but really talk about the systemic kinds of changes from policies that were enacted in the history of the state and the country that really created the kind of inequity we see? And then how do we get at that inequity in a real transformative way?
And there's not much more central than the budget in a state and the policy that's embedded in the legislation around it, right?
That's right. We've often said the budget is the moral document. It tells you what the priorities are and how you're funding them or how you're not. So that's where we would give an account to what is the value statement that state governors and legislatures are naming when they are funding or not funding certain things. It speaks volumes.
I assume when you were president and CEO there that you came to some theories about leadership and management. What advice would you give to someone running a similar type of organization about how to do it well?
I would say being outcomes oriented is really important. You can have brilliant staff and resources galore, and maybe not, but I do think whether you have a lot of resources to do the work or you are struggling, it's really important to have your folks with real clarity of a vision and how their work contributes to that vision. And I'm learning that even now at Demos. But what I appreciated about the work at GBPI was that we were able to take an organization that was very much in the posture of playing defense and trying to beat back all the bad things and got to a point where we could sort of proclaim the vision that we wanted and organize our work to help affect that. And what I realized too, as a think tank leader, that you've got to have all the right functions to help you be successful. What I wanted to do at that particular time was to take and make sure that we weren't just seeing success as writing the paper and getting it posted on the website and maybe getting a reporter to say, hey, the organization just produced some findings and here they are. If nothing fundamentally changes with the policies and the systems and people's lives, then what are we doing? You know? And so for me, it was having that clarity. And I think that's really important for a leader. And again, having had it at GBPI and knowing that I've got to continue to articulate that as a new leader at the national level, I've got to make sure that I've got the right kind of coaching and supports to help me. So I would just offer that too as something for leaders to think about. What is the kind of coaching and support that they need to show up in the right ways for their teams, to have the right kind of leadership team to help them shepherd the work, I think is another really important element.
I have talked to a number of coaches of progressive organizations along the way. Is there someone that you have talked to that you found helpful or groups that you've attended? I mean, you're promoting that. Is there something that you have in mind or suggestions of where people could go to for that kind of help?
I think there's a number of resources out there. And what I would say, people have to know what they need. Our organization, and I know a lot of folks have used people like the Management Center, and they've approached it in a very thoughtful way, helping create structures for folks. I've also had some independent consultants that have just shown up for me. I've really appreciated my time at the Leadership from the Inside Out, a year-long leadership fellowship at Rockwood Institute, which has done some phenomenal coaching around leadership and equity and just thinking about what you need to transform organizations. And then I believe that there's an important element for folks to take care of themselves. Like right now, I have a somatic coach who is trying to help me have the right kind of self-care practices because the stress is real, my friend. The stress is real. So how do we take care of ourselves in the right kind of ways so that we can be good leaders, to be healthy leaders, to lead our organizations? That's a really important piece.
I completely believe in that. Something I learned only along the way in my own career, but have talked to people like Robert Gass, who was a co-founder of Rockwood, and Management Center founder and things like that. And I think wherever you find it, whether it's like an executive coach or a group of peers, can be very helpful. I want to ask you now about your how you came to this particular job. Now, you're moving out of a state level organization, however prominent, to something that I've heard about nationally for many years. Did they recruit you? Did you see a listing? How did it come to be that you land where you land?
So I had a great opportunity to come on to the staff of Demos.
Oh, right. You had said that you were on the board. Tell me how you got on the board originally.
Yes, yes. So I joined the board of Demos in 2017 under Heather McGee's leadership.
Yeah.
And part of that role was to sort of bring a state policy voice to the board to really help inform Demos's work. Demos is a very movement-oriented think tank, but it also was very important for them to have sort of state policy perspective on the board. So I was invited to join in 2017. And also I had a chance to serve on the presidential search committee when Heather stepped down. So I had an opportunity to build really good relationship with Sabil Rahman, who was our CEO or president prior to me. He served for about 2.5 years. And I, again, was a board member at that time supporting his leadership. And then he had a great opportunity to go into the administration in 2021. And I had just come off of a sabbatical in 2021. When this opportunity came, I was liaising with the staff as through the transition, and the board asked me, the leadership, would I be willing to be interim president? And I said no. I wasn't going to leave my great job, and you know, coming fresh off a sabbatical at GBPI, and with everything happening during the pandemic in 2020, I said, "Look, I had a vision for wanting to build out a worker power center within our organization to really focus on building power for workers, given what happened during the pandemic, and Georgia was a hot spot for essential workers, and we opened up the economy early. So all those things were really weighing on me. And then when this opportunity came, it hit me that." Perhaps my vision is bigger than the state of Georgia, and I would like to be able to think about the country and think about national work to really make sure that we have an inclusive democracy and economy. And so when we did a national search for the position, I did put my name in the hat, and here I am.
You certainly were serving on the board and working in Georgia at a time, let's just call it the rise of Trump time, unfortunately. How did that affect your view of national politics and policy?
Well, what it really did was show me that, you know, as I hear even now with our movement partners, that our democracy, state legislatures is the battleground. They are the battlegrounds. And so kind of having this time in Georgia to build my sort of policy and my analytical muscle, but also what we did at GBPI under my leadership was be really intentional about building the kind of relationships and partnerships with movement-oriented organizations. Again, we can come up with all the policy ideas and solutions all day long, but if we're not connecting it to sort of the civic engagement, sort of organizations who are going to move and push on those ideas, then we're not being effective, you know, as thinkers and thought leaders. And so that was a really important element for me. And when I think about the kind of impact that the civic engagement groups had in Georgia during the rise of Trump, and again, 2020 being such an important election where you had Black and brown communities show up in such incredible ways 3 times from the election to the runoff, the kind of activism and motivation that people had to actually come out was really, really important. So to take that now to the national level, I know that there are so many more organizations on the playing field that care about, you know, a multiracial democracy. And that's something that has been part of Demos' 24-year history. But also knowing that there are seldom organizations that connect the dots. We've always said that the economy and the democracy are linked. They are one. And I too often have these conversations at separate tables. You know, we're talking about the economy over here and the democracy conversations are being had over here. But if we know economic power and political power, they are linked and the people don't have it, right? We continue to see the rise of corporations and the wealthy elites who are really having a outsized influence on our democracy and on the economy. And so how do we build the kind of power for the people, which is Demos's name, is part of like why I get up every day and why I think I was excited when this opportunity fell into my lap and I was able to be appointed to this role. I know that this is such a daunting time. And I think as a national organization, we've got to figure out one, what is the ground game, right? Because it's not going to all happen at the federal level. And a lot of folks think the federal level is broken with rules like the filibuster and some of these arcane Jim Crow-esque practices. They keep us from actually solving some of the problems of increasing the federal minimum wage and the PRO Act and some of these other policies that are publicly supported and people believe in, but we have stalemate in the Senate. So those are the things that frustrate me about the federal government, and putting all our eggs in that basket is probably not the right idea. It has to be a both and. We have to look at, you know, what needs to happen at the state level, which is where a lot of these decisions are being made that impact people's lives each and every day.
So you mentioned that Demos is 24 years old, and you've talked about a couple of the previous leaders that were right before you. But for people who are not too familiar, can you sort of explain what is this group that you head up and how they fit into the progressive ecosystem more generally?
Yes. So Demos has been around for 24 years. We'll have our 25th anniversary next year. It was founded by Stephen Hintz, Charlie Hepburn, and David Callinan, three white men who at that time in 2000 said, looking at, and I had this conversation with Stephen Hintz, who is the president of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, in sort of my interview about what's the origin story, why Demos? And his point to me was, you know, looking at democracy globally, you see a lot of the things that can be done to really help and make it a more inclusive democracy. But what he learned and recognized then, which is why this is in the DNA of Demos, is you can't have outsized economic inequality and have an inclusive democracy. And so the notion is that we've got to tackle economic inequality to be able to have the kind of inclusive democracy that we need. And so this is why Demos has done this work at the intersection. And in this historical sort of evolution of our organization under Miles Rappaport and Heather McGee in particular, and Heather, of course, is a huge champion and voice around why systemic racism has been a problem, and it's a problem for everyone, is that we have to do this work with a racial equity lens. When we think about wanting to have a multiracial democracy to ensure that everyone can participate and have a voice and a say, that we have to be really intentional about that racial equity analysis, because based on the policy choices of the past, we have excluded historically communities of color. And I think that analysis is critical. And that's what Demos has provided over these last 24 years. And we've done work around voting rights and democracy reform in the courts. We've been litigating in places. We have done legal advocacy. We have done research and policy work around voting rights. And we also have done some bigger sort of economic projects around credit card reform, around canceling student debt. But before that, it was debt-free college, which was a big project of Demos. So we've tried to mainstream some of these big ideas over the years to really get at economic inequality and ensuring that our democracy can include everyone's voice.
When you talk about sort of having a racial lens or some of these policies fighting inequality, there's quite a backlash right now on the right and among the Republican Party towards them. And they're using that politically. And sometimes people in the Democratic Party or allied parts of the electoral arena want to run away from that because it can be sometimes not helpful electorally in the short run, perhaps. How do you think about that intersection between the movement ideas that you guys represent and the political moment and the politics of trying to win in order to govern and in order to do this kind of thing?
That is such a debate, as you mentioned, and a frustration point for me as I think about where we are historically. And what I've been noting, you know, as a student of democracy reform, you know, as I mentioned, I've been coming at this from the economic policy side. So as I've been reading the books and getting really deeper on like how this democracy was formed and who was included, coming from Philadelphia, where the Declaration was written, they excluded people who look like me. Just thinking about how there is an approach that you have to have the multiracial coalition to actually be able to move these ideas. And there are people who have to continue to move and impress upon sort of that middle, right? The persuadables to be able to come alongside and be good allies and good co-conspirators, particularly for white Americans or white folks who, you know, I think are clutching their pearls right now because they feel like their power is being lessened because there's a growing demographic and there's a shift that is happening in this country. And for me to read the history books on the narratives post-Reconstruction, we had a moment after the emancipation where there was multiracial democracy, right? We had governing that was with Black folks, with white folks, and that only lasted 11 to 12 years. Before white supremacists snatched back that power and we went into a Jim Crow Black codes for decades. And so now we are 60 years out of the civil rights movement where we finally, with the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, are at a point where we can try to have a multiracial democracy where Black and brown folks, particularly Black folks, because they were the proponents, strong proponents of the civil rights movement, could actually do the things, could show up and not be discriminated against and have opportunity and sit at the counters and engage in commerce and those sorts of things. We're at a moment now where there is another sort of redemption moment, like we saw post-Reconstruction, where the same narratives about white folks feeling discriminated against and they're feeling like their rights are being taken away, when all we have been trying to do in these last 60 plus years post-civil rights is to ensure that there's equitable opportunities for people who have been historically excluded. I think we still have to come with the racial equity analysis and with the proof points and the receipts of the history and tell that story. And I know that there's hard work that has to be done to get back to our values as a nation, our values as humanity, that all of us ultimately want freedom and liberation. It's not just for white people, right? And you hear these national narratives about freedom and liberty and all the things, but that's what Native Americans wanted, right? When their land was stolen. That's what Black and brown people wanted through slavery. And even in these moments to freely be able to engage in our economy. So I am getting a little hyper here because I feel like we're playing into this narrative again of sort of whiteness. And I want my white friends and brothers, sisters, and those non-binary folks in the world to understand that at the end of the day, this is about humanity. This is about everyone being able to be valued, to be seen. Everyone wants to be able to thrive. And if we can't come and stand on that kind of values system as a nation, then we're going to be lost. That work has to happen in terms of like appealing to all of our hearts and minds, but also at the end of the day, making the case that we have to change history, we have to repair the harms, and we have to ensure that this rising demographic has opportunity. And that's where I'm very intentional about being race explicit in this moment.
It feels like we are in a very close battle between the forces that agree with you and the forces that don't, that characterizes our time. It is as explicit on the right what they are trying to do as it's been in a century or more, perhaps. And if we don't organize on our side in defense or proactively in favor of our values, then we're in trouble. We're going to be swamped over.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the fear that I hear from not only my movement partners and movement friends who are doing this groundwork and knocking on doors and canvassing, there's a real fear what this next iteration of this presidential election and America can be. And I know people think we're being hyperbolic about authoritarianism, but there's a real chance that we will be moving from this sort of representative democracy in this republic to a real authoritarian autocracy because it's been named. And when I think about the conversations I've had with folks who identify as trans or LGBTQ+, they already said, Taifa, we're already living in under a totalitarian government, right? Where the government is telling them how they should be, who they should be, and what they can do.
In certain parts of the country.
In certain parts of the country, yes.
Yeah.
And so to see these kinds of policies proliferate state by state by state, which again underscores that this work has to happen at the state level in order for it to have real sort of transformative change.
And the Republicans want to nationalize those kind of anti-group policies. That is what they would like to do, and that's what they intend to do. Tell me a little bit about what are the current projects at Demos. What are the things that you guys are putting your efforts into and why?
Yes. So we are launching at the end of March is a power agenda. Part of this for me is I coming into this role 2.5 years ago and really thinking about what's the next iteration of Demos's work. How can we really join and be a part of this progressive ecosystem that is demanding and dreaming and envisioning a multiracial democracy? And what I see is our contribution can be really clear on building power with and for Black and Brown communities. And the reason why I come at this clarity on power, it's not that power building hasn't been happening. Our folks in the field have been doing this day in and day out. But as a think tank or public policy organization who is all about structural reform, how do we think about building the kind of structural reform that actually builds the kind of economic and political power for this growing demographic? Our power agenda framework that we're releasing is going to really be an aspirational vision for where Demos's work will situate over the next couple of years. And we're proclaiming some very universal goals. One is an economic security for all. And we want everyone to be able to meet their basic needs. All right. That is something that is just necessary in order for all of us to be able to thrive. Second pillar to that is that we have economic mobility for all. What we're seeing now based on the data is that this next generation will fare less than the generations before. And we know that a large part of this is how do we think about wealth and assets and worker power as we think about the trajectory for people living in this country. The third pillar of this is full political participation. How do we ensure that everyone can not just engage, that I would say all of our democratic systems really fully embrace everyone. We'll be looking specifically at ways to ensure immigrant families have access to the ballot, looking at things like language access, and also looking at those who continue to face sort of exclusion and marginalization, which are systems impacted folks who are coming back into the community who should not have been disenfranchised in the first place. So we'll be looking at some project work around that. The other is an inclusive and expansive electorate. And so as we think about this rising demographic, what are the ways that we can ensure that people are engaging again and don't face barriers to that kind of engagement? And then the final is around a responsible, accountable government. And this is where our money and politics work will live, in addition to our court reform, and also thinking about how can government operate in a way that communities, constituents, the people can sit at the table and influence the decisions, have like insight into what's happening, and the need for transparency is a really important part of governing. And so those are some of the big pillars that we'll be looking at to build power over the next couple of years.
When you talk about that, there's a certain overlap with the Democratic Party platform nationally or in states where they control it. There are points where you might differ or have difference in emphasis. I assume the aspiration of any group like yours is to have what you are suggesting adopted broadly and articulated broadly. How do you work to make that happen? And what do you see as the connections that people are making to what you're trying to promulgate? It sounds like you're about to release a new version of that, and what's actually happening out there.
Yes, I think there's a both and to that, you know, and as we're in the process of rebuilding Demos, our talent and the right kind of apparatus to be able to do this next iteration of work, we've always prided ourselves on our deep, you know, relationships with the field. And what I also know as a research leader of a think tank, have done this kind of work for a while, is that, you know, you can't be a thought leader and not be tethered and grounded or have your finger on the pulse of what's actually happening in the field and in community. So I think that's going to be an important strategy for us to move these ideas. What I've heard from our Inclusive Democracy Project partners, Demos has been sort of convening a group of state-based economic justice, racial justice groups for the last 9 years or so. And I hear from them, they're located in about 19 states and DC, that they want to think about a national campaign. And they've been very frustrated with not only the political apparatus, but sort of philanthropy, picking and choosing states based on whether it's movable or, you know, who are the players. And they said democracy is under attack in every state. And how can we advance a more collaborative, synergistic vision for what we want for our democracy? So I really feel even with inside the Beltway, work that has to be done to actually move national policy is just as important for us, and maybe even more so, to have a real sense of where there is traction and opportunity at the state level. And when I think about, again, if all is important in our universal goals, if a multiracial democracy means that everyone, regardless of your race, your religion, your background, can participate fully, then where are the places where those barriers most exist? And because of the historic exclusion we've seen in this country, I might want to look at where most of those barriers are still stood up or even now burgeoning all over the country, and looking at the demographics and what the opportunities are for us to really support the ground with the kind of ideas, with the policies, with the talking points. And I know Demos isn't necessarily cut out to do that fully now, but that's the vision that I see for this organization, who, again, is part of a broader ecosystem. But I'm thinking about how can we ensure our movement, the civic engagement apparatus. Someone in California, a donor table leader, said to me, there's a huge investment in the power building infrastructure. But he said, Taifa, I really feel like Demos could help with the power wielding infrastructure. And so how do we help with the right kind of policies and ideas? And again, the frustration here is, yes, there is tinkering and reforms that can happen when you think about wages and when you think about healthcare. And we're not a healthcare provider, so our lane is pretty much economy and democracy. But there are those things that are around the edges that are low-hanging fruit, you know. Federal minimum wage, increase the thing. It hasn't been increased for 13, 14 years. That would prove critical for helping people be able to have the kind of thriving wages they need. But also, what's the transformative things? Like, what's the things that nobody else is thinking about? My team wants time to be able to do that. So there's the both and there. We got a dream beyond capitalism. There's a lot of effort and energy around post-neoliberalism. And what does that mean? But again, based on our racially capitalistic society, how can we really reimagine an economy where we own, we co-own, we control, we're not exploited, people can thrive and live and not have to work 15, 11 jobs to be able to support their families? Those are the kind of things that we really want to imagine.
I think that you and your staff and the people who listen to you operate so much in this world of ideas and data and related things that policy analysts care about and that actually are connected to the real world and the way people live. But a lot of campaigning, particularly right now, is very emotional, very devoid of ideas, almost explicitly sometimes. We're being taken away, we're being misled, we're being tricked, I think, into focusing on who is bad rather than finding some solidarity. How do you integrate an ideas institute into a battle that isn't always fought in ideas? How do you think about that? I mean, like, how can you translate what you want into a language that regular people can digest and be for and be part of the coalition, I think, to stop what might very well take place without it at a national level and as in process in a lot of states?
Yes, yes. Well, you know, the model that I have is, you know, the 10 plus years that I've done this work in at the state level. And I think that model can work nationally, but it goes back to having deep relationships. I hear so often that national groups have their agenda, they have their ideas, and they're just swooping down and telling people, you know, we're the smartest people in the room, and these are the things that you should do. So I just really think in this moment where we do have to do some hard work and some persuading is part of what will make us effective or not as an organization. So to that point, our team has thought about our own theory of change of wanting to do sort of structural reforms. We know we got to get at the policy change, but we also have to, we can't see the narrative ground. You know, what we hear on the right now is so much counter to all of our values, you know, sort of the personal responsibility and the real Americans, even the notion that diversity is toxic, right? There's a narrative that is being played out that is undermining our message around systemic racism and the sort of receipts that we have that has shown why we have the inequality that we see in our democracy and in our economy and why we need equity. And equity may mean we need to do more for some groups who've been marginalized versus others. And that is the thing that is being demonized right now. And so I just think, to your point, there are folks, and this is the thing that frustrates me, which I realize why I don't need to be a politician, because I can't play politics. But there are the things that are politically expedient, where you're going to make a decision based on whether it's good politics. And really, my work is about how to convince people about good policy.
Yeah, but you got to get people in a position so that they can actually govern to do it. And that's part of the challenge. One of the interesting things about our many ship armada is that there's different roles for different groups, and that may be the role of your group to do that. But if you were advising political leaders, I'm sure you do from time to time, what would you want them to be saying on some of these core things? What would you like to be hearing from a governor of Pennsylvania or the president of the United States or a local office holder in a small town somewhere that fits with the vision that your group has?
Yes. I think anything that we can do to make government work for everyone and really address some of the threats that is this authoritarianism where government is going to make and control everything. And I think there's a real fear, and I've heard this, you know, from the right, is that this is why you don't want to have everybody be able to access the ballot. You really don't want a direct democracy because you don't want the people to control. And that's a problem for me to have and talk to leaders about how to solve the issues of economic inequality. You know, there are a host of ways that we can do that through reforms to wages, to corporate accountability, to more oversight.
And do you hear people saying that? Do you hear that?
I hear some, but not all.
I mean, I don't think that you talked about, some people might think it's hyperbole, the threat we face. I don't think it is. I think that it's a pretty dire potential situation here. But when you think about what you see in the world that you inhabit, what is giving you the most hope about the future?
what I see coming from the field. There are so many brilliant, talented leaders in states across the country who are really doing some incredible work. One of our partners in New Mexico just got a Voting Rights Act passed at the state level. And I see more of that happening across the country. The kind of wins on child care reforms and child tax credits at the local level, those are the things that really excite me to see that not only are people fighting to ensure that people are engaging and being activated around elections, but they're actually standing up some really incredible campaigns and some visions that really are inclusive. And those things excite me about the future, and especially seeing how young people are engaging right now.
Taifa, what should I have asked you that I failed to?
I feel like we've covered a good bit.
I think we have. It's been an honor to talk to you. Is there anything else you want to say?
No, I think I'm good. If you feel good, I feel good.
Well, I feel good about you and the work you're doing. I feel nervous about my country and its direction, but I think we got a lot of work to do between now and the election and beyond. So
we do.
We'll be there.
And I guess I would just finally say, we went to the movies last weekend and saw a preview of a movie called Civil War. And I just said, oh, this is too close to home. It hit too close. And I fear, even as I'm hopeful, that the continuous messaging and the devaluing of immigrants and people of color, and what I'm hopeful of, that people see, as much as this anti-woke, anti-CRT, anti-agenda around not wanting to make white people feel bad about the past or have any ownership of the history, is to me anti-democratic. It's like, how can we talk about ourselves as humanity and a nation when we are intentionally closing off ourselves to being honest and truthful about our history and to name it, but also know that there has to be some reconciliation. And I fear that the more this culture war happens, that we'll get further and further away from the kind of reconciliation and problem solving that we really need in this country.
When you think about our side and how we're organized, do you think we are doing a good job of fighting this fight, or do you have any prescription for how to do it better?
Whew.
It's a big question.
It's a big question. I will say, I feel that there are some leaders who really are listening to the field. You had this big movement a few years ago to trust the people on the ground, trust Black women, you know, who are holding up our democracy and leading a lot of the civic engagement work around the country. I just think that politicians, and as you see now, even with this administration, having the kind of reckoning with young people around Palestine and Israel, we have to really listen to the public and to the demos to get where we need to go collectively as a country. And I just hope that our politicians are really bending their ear to the people and their needs.
I hope so too. And it's a broad set of people with a lot of different needs. It's not easy for anybody, but I hope that they find a way to navigate it. And I really appreciate you taking the time today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. Really appreciate it.
That was Taifa. She is at demos.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found. The Great Battlefield is now part of the Democracy Group Podcast Network. Visit democracygroup.org to learn more about other podcasts that cover democracy and civic engagement. You can also help me by leaving comments and good ratings on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere, and by sending me suggestions for great guests to nperlman@gmail.com.